Welcome everybody. Today to Torah and Tea. Today we're doing the portion of Ekev, but we have some very special dates of the month that we want to cover and talk about a little bit. Maybe a little bit later about the Parsha, but first tonight is the 15th of Av. Chamisha Asar B'Av, Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av. The Talmud states about the 15th of Av that this was one of the greatest holidays. Actually, the Gemara says 2 days were the greatest holidays. Yom Kippur and Chamisha Asar B'Av and the 15th of Av. The Gemara asks, well, Yom Kippur is a holiday, it's a day of atonement, so we're all forgiven, so we're going to celebrate. That is understood, but what's the holiday of the 15th day of Av? What's so special? What happened there? And the Gemara relates, there was a whole process, there was a lot of matches, there was a lot of shidduch, young couples were made on this day, but it seems like there were always different standard of people. Some came from rich families, some came from influential families, some came from plain families. And yet, it seems like everybody got an opportunity to shine. And the Talmud actually said that nobody would wear their own clothing that they own, but rather they would borrow from one another so that nobody should be embarrassed if they don't have the most beautiful clothing. It was not only that, I'm sorry, wedding clothing. It was getting ready. It was the gowns for the wedding. But it was meant in a way to create a union. And the joy was sort of across all different levels of the population and everybody to rejoice. And the Talmud goes on, you know, the various different things, what they would declare in order to attract the boys to them, what their special qualities are, etc., etc. So that's tonight. Tonight is the 15th of Av, and we don't say Tachanun already by Mincha tomorrow, and that's a festive day. We don't really have outside of not saying the Tachanun, omitting the Tachanun from the prayers, there's no actual acts, you know, what you do. Some people make a mock wedding or something like that just to pretend, but it's nevertheless considered to be a very great celebration. Now, it's interesting because most of the time when we talk about the month of Av, we talk about it as a sad month. We always think about Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, which is the culmination, and that's the saddest day of the year on Tisha B'Av and the ninth of Av. And then after the Tisha B'Av, we come to actually one of the greatest celebrations. We call this the greatest holiday, the 15th of Av. And it's explained that because it comes after this calamity and after the experience of the destruction, that's why the joy is so much greater, so much deeper. It's so much more profound because we're coming after Tisha B'Av. So it's like turning darkness to light, you know, when you were able to celebrate instead of mourning, that means a whole lot. And maybe that's also the reason. Usually the 15th day of the month is considered like a powerful time because the moon is a full moon. And we know that the Jewish people are, compared to the moon, we do the special blessing Kiddush HaChodesh when the new moon comes in. And the moon keeps on increasing, and its final and greatest height is the 15th of the month. But especially in Menachem Av, because it comes after Tisha B'Av, and after the days, the 9 days that preceded from the beginning of Av, that's why it gets such a simcha. That's why it brings the greatest joy, because of the turnaround. And then we have another mark, another special day, but this is more in the Chabad Hasidic calendar, because on the 20th day of Av is the Yahrzeit, the day of passing, the Hilula of the great saintly rabbi and genius, and also a great Kabbalist, Rabbi Levi Yitzchok Schneerson, the father of our Rebbe. The Rebbe's father was the chief rabbi of a large major city in the former Soviet Union in Russia, and the city of Yekaterinoslav, now it's known as Dnepropetrovsk, but the city over there had quite a large Jewish population, but the times were very difficult for Jews, and especially for religious Jews. And the rabbis who stood strong and tried to preserve and to sustain Yiddishkeit to the extent possible. And the Rebbe's father was one of the rabbis who, with total self-sacrifice and dedication, assisted by his wife, the Rebbetzin Chana, the Rebbe's mother, and they were there helping the Jewish people, the community, and also during the war, there was a lot of displaced people, there was a lot of army people that were traveling, and the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin took it upon themselves to provide for the needs such as matzahs and other religious needs of the soldiers and of these refugees who were coming to Yekaterinoslav in the hundreds and thousands. And they kept up Jewish life to the extent possible. Now, the Rebbe's father was very well connected in the government circles. Unfortunately, some of the children and grandchildren of the Hasidim of the past themselves turned into the movement, Jewish communist movement, and they joined them. And they caused also a lot of problems for their own people, for their parents and for their own people. But still, there was a spark there, and they had a certain level of respect for the Rebbe's father, for Rebbe Levi Yitzchok, and they helped in various different ways, as there's many, many anecdotes and many stories. The Rebbe Levi Yitzchok, he was unique, great genius. Not only did he know all the Talmud and all the Halacha perfectly inside out, backwards and forwards, but he was also a tremendous Kabbalist with a genius mind. and his writings are full with various different hints and gematrias and bringing people, things together. A very, very brilliant and takes a lot of effort to even try to understand his teachings. There's a personal story that my father, may he rest in peace, told about him and the Rebbe's father, Rebbe Levi Yitzchak. My father, a blessed memory, was involved with the underground yeshiva in the Soviet Union. He was involved in various different matters. He was still a student. He was not married yet. And for married people, it was doubly danger to get involved in helping the yeshivas. The yeshivas needed help in various different areas. First of all, financially, because they needed to pay, they needed for some food, they needed to pay for some basic things. So you needed to raise money and you needed to disseminate the money, bring the money all over. All these things, in those days, owning money, having money, disseminating, these were all crimes. You know, these were all things that you were not allowed to do. They needed people to help find new places for the underground yeshivas. The way it would work, there was no official building. They would go to the shul and they'd ask the attendant of the shul if they can bring a bunch of kids there, 10, 12, 15 kids, whatever the number was, and they'd get somebody teaching them. But that was only good for a while, because until the local government, they found out about it and they kicked them out of there and they went to the next shul. A lot of the shuls didn't want to take them, you know, but it was more dangerous to teach for married people, because in that case, they would catch you and send you away to the gulag and give you exile for 10 years. You had a wife and children, and would be a lot more devastating. So what they did instead, they tried to find unmarried people who were not as dangerous. It wasn't as the impact would not be as severe as when you're talking about taking away a married man from his family and his wife and his children. So my father served as all of these, bringing money, testing the students, bringing them various different aspects. In one of his trips, and that was already after the previous Rebbe has left the country, and basically the Hasidim were left without the Rebbe as their leader, and amongst themselves, they organized themselves, headed by Rebbe Yoina HaKoy, Rebbe Yoina Poltaver. There was various different great Hasidim, and they led that movement. So my father at one point was transferring money from the central place to the underground yeshiva where he was going to. And my father told me that in those days it wasn't normal for people to wear a beard. Everybody shaved. Today we have hippies, we have a lot of rabbis, but there was over there only the frum people had a beard. So you were very easily identifiable, and it made you a target immediately, both of the anti-Semites and also of the authorities to go searching for you. So my father used to say he never touched his beard, and for religious reasons, and he used to walk around with a scarf sort of around his face. In those days, people that had a toothache, instead of going to the doctor or whatever, they put a bandage, like a scarf around, he would sort of disguise it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But anyways, in one of his stops, he waited at the train station in Yekaterinoslav, and they caught him. And they put him into a holding cell, or jail, whatever. I think it must be in a holding cell before, at the police station. And knowing my father's nature, as I know him when he was older already, he was a person that was very, very devastated. That he was very scared. You know, he was not a very macho kind of person. And I knew that it must have scared him terribly. You know, it would scare anybody. But I know especially him, he must have been petrified. And they locked him up because they found that he was carrying a large sum of money, which was not allowed. And then they were going to start up with investigation, everything else. So in the meantime, they put him into the holding cell in the police station. It was a dark room. It was a window on the top over there where they put him. And the way my father relates it, that he saw through the window, it was a Jewish town, he saw there was a from Jew passing by the window. He was able to communicate with him. And he told him, go tell the rabbi, Reb Levi Yitzchak Schneerson, go tell him that Nachum Volosov, he called him by his name, has been caught and arrested over here. And see what he can do. And my father said that this was sort of a miracle that this never happened. All of a sudden, a little bit time later, apparently he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe pulled his connections. The Rebbe had a lot of connections in the local police and local government. And the guy walks into his cell, walks into the holding cell, and he says, "You, here's your package." Gives him back his money. He says, "Take the first train and get so fast out of here. I don't want to see you here ever again." And he let him go. And without my father providing concrete evidence, my father said he has no doubt it was Reb Levi Yitzchak who saved his life then, who intervened. And he says, otherwise it just didn't make any sense for them just to come in and let him go and give him back the money and everything else, and they just let him continue. He says, just don't come back again. And
do we know what town it was, Rabbi?
Yeah, it was in Yekaterinoslav, in Nepepetrovsk.
Oh, it was Yekaterinoslav.
Yeah. Eventually, however, these evil people, these Rishayim, they did get to Reb Levi Yitzchak, and they sentenced him to exile in Kazakhstan. And first they send him to some no man's land over there. It is the physical, the Rebbetzin writes up a little place called Chiali. The Rebbetzin writes up the physical suffering, the heat and the mosquitoes, and all kinds of, and the no room to stay and to sleep. It was just a miserable, miserable, miserable time over there. But the biggest problem for scholars and learned people is they don't have anybody to converse with, and they don't have the books, and they don't have the ability to write their thoughts. That's a torture for their soul. And the Rebbe, the Rebbetzin, she traveled back home to Leningrad, where the Yekaterinoslav, in this case, sorry, Yekaterinoslav, and she brought the Rebbe some of his books, a few books, the Tanya, the Zohar, a few books. And she also learned how to make ink and paper from the grass. It was a whole... And today we have several books written all over the edges of the books, the Rebbe's father's writings in the very deep analytical and esoteric ideas. It's like amazing. And eventually, when he finished the sentence, they moved to Almaty. That's the main of Kazakhstan. That's the main over there. It's, situation was a little bit better, but then he got very sick, the Rebbe's father, and he passed away on the 20th day of Av. That's why we're remembering, and the 20th day of Av is the yahrzeit of the Rebbe's father. The Rebbe would always make a verbringen, would always make a gathering in honor of the yahrzeit of his father. And one of the talks that the Rebbe...
What year this was?
That he passed away, that was in 1944, approximately, I think. It was 1944. He wasn't that old yet. He was in his, I think, late 50s, early 60s. I don't know. I just didn't look it up. I forget the dates. But it was not very old, and... the Rebbe would forbring, and the Rebbe brought up an interesting question as, first of all, the date of 20th of was celebrated by some of the families. Where do you find the 20th of Av? So you're always looking for a source in the Talmud. The Talmud relates that when the Jewish people came up at the Second Temple and there was no wood in the rooms of the temple to bring for a fire on the altar, on the Mizbeach, so there were families that brought wood, contributed wood, so that the Mizbeach can have wood. And those days that they brought the wood, that was celebrated as their holiday on the 20th of Av. One of the families on the 20th of Av. And the Rebbe has an interesting discussion from this Talmud. What happens... and at that the celebration and that day, they would bring the wood. They would bring the wood first of all for the mizbeach, so that everybody else can bring when they need it throughout the year. And number two, they'd actually bring a sacrifice of wood, which means they would burn the wood as a korban. First of all, it was used to bring other sacrifices on the wood that they contributed. And second of all, they also made a special korban called the korban etzim, the korban of wood. And the Mishnah discusses over there what happens if the 20th of Av is on Shabbos. So, of course, it doesn't override the Shabbos, bringing the wood. You can't do it on Shabbos. When do you bring the wood? Do you bring it on Friday before Shabbos, or do you bring it on Sunday after Shabbos? So without going into the whole discussion over there, there is an idea that says that before the day comes, there's no obligation yet. It's almost like a vow. When you make a vow, you can't make up the vow before the vow was made. So if they made a promise that they're going to bring it on the 20th, that's the gift. If they bring it before, there's that idea that then they are not really fulfilling their vow, because that's something separate, because that's not the vow. They want to learn. There's one idea that says, no, you first have to wait for the day to arrive. You need the 20th of Av to come, and then you'll bring the later on, because then you're bringing it for your obligation. If you bring it earlier, you're not obligated yet, then it doesn't count. So the Rebbe brings this down also with regards today. Some people have a tradition to give special tzedakah on a yahrzeit of a parent. Some people actually have a tradition to fast on the yahrzeit of a parent. And the question becomes, if the yahrzeit comes out on a Shabbos, when do you give that extra tzedakah and when do you fast? Do you do it on Friday before Shabbos? Or you do it after Shabbos on Sunday? According to this idea we learned in the Gemara, that it would seem like you have to wait first for the day to come, because that's when your obligation, you made a vow almost to say that on the yahrzeit I will fast, on the yahrzeit I will give tzedakah. But if you give tzedakah and you fast before the yahrzeit, you are not fulfilling your vow, because your vow wasn't then yet, that's before your vow. So that's extra. So therefore you should do it after. But the Rebbe argues, the Rebbe says, at the time when a person makes a vow to give tzedakah or to fast, he knows that sometimes it'll be on a Shabbos. We know that the yahrzeits come out on Shabbos. So to begin with the vow, we don't want to push off a mitzvah, whether it's tzedakah or fasting for the yahrzeit. We don't want to push it off for afterwards. Originally, when you undertake and when you make a decision to fast on the yahrzeit of your parent or to give tzedakah on the yahrzeit of your parent, you initially take into account that sometimes it'll be on Shabbos. And if it does fall on Shabbos, then you're going to be fasting and giving tzedakah before. So it's not called fasting before the time arrived. That's actually the time, because that was the consideration that you had in the beginning when you originally is that there is going to be a time like that. The Rebbe goes through various different ideas over here, but that's beyond the scope. And let's just do a little bit of the next in our parsha. Of course, we talk about blessing Hashem. The pasuk talks about when you eat in the parsha's Akif. When you eat and you're satisfied, you should make a blessing. You should bless God, your God. Now, that's the only blessing, really, that the Torah talks about for food. We know that any food that we eat, we make a blessing. But from the Torah, the only food you make a blessing on is not before you eat, is after you eat and you're satisfied, which basically means after you eat bread, that's when you make the grace after meal, the Birchat HaMazon, that is the Torah command. And the Rebbe has a whole big discussion about the way these laws are brought down in Maimonides, the way they're brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, and the way in the Siddur. The Rebbe explains that the Alter Rebbe, basically, halacha, he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. What is the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch is a collection of laws. And unlike the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karud, the big Shulchan Aruch, over there he doesn't bring any reasoning at all. He just puts the halacha there, where Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Shulchan Aruch, he will give some of the reasoning. And the thing is that when you don't have the reasoning, you don't really know sometimes how to compare. Because if you don't know the reason, so how are you going to deal in not the exact case? So actually, reasonings are very helpful to understanding the material and to know how to equate it. So the Alter Rebbe writes some reasoning. But then the Alter Rebbe also wrote in his Siddur some brief halachas, the laws. Those were not a collection. Those were just a practical, those were like a guide of a how to do. You know, it's not like a code of law, but it's just a how to do it. So he will write some laws about how to put on the tefillin, how to do the Birkat HaShachar, how to put on the tzitzis, how to say the Shema. He'll have selected halachas. They are not really... And the Rebbe points out, based on this principle, various changes in languages that the Alter Rebbe uses. One of the things we learn from the Pasuk, even though it says very clearly, Ubeirachta es Hashem Elokecha, what that means, you should bless God your God. But in the Torah, whenever it says the word es, it comes to include something in addition. As, for example, when it says, Kabed es avicha, honor es avicha, your father, the es imecha, and your mother. What is the es coming? Oh, you also must honor your older brother. You also must honor es. It says, es Hashem alekecha tira, God you should fear. Also, a sage you have to fear. So here, the word Es Hashem Elokecha is understood that you also bless Hashem, but also the master. If you're eating a meal in someone's house, you have to bless the owner of the house. And that is why one of the traditions is, one of the laws is, that you honor with the benching the guests, so therefore the guests can later on say that special blessing we do in the end of the Birchat HaMazon. We do it anyways. We do it. Balabais has a Sovi Merosi, but Balabais, we talk about blessing the master of the home. And that's learned out Es Hashem Elokecha. But the Torah command is only the grace after meal. But if you think about it, why are we blessing Hashem? The verse explains. The verse says, "V'achalta v'savata," because you ate and you were satisfied, which means you benefited, you enjoyed. You were hungry before, and now you're satisfied. You have to bless Hashem. This teaches us, really, that any time we benefit from the world, we should bless the owner of everything, which the whole world, LaHashem Ha'aretz U'Malo'a, the whole world and everything that fills the world is essentially belongs to Hashem. And we say, if you're not going to say thank you Hashem by making a bracha, then you're really eating what doesn't belong to you, because you don't have permission. It is Hashem's. The only way Hashem gives you permission is if you make the bracha. How do we know that? Because you see, when you benefit, when you enjoy, you have to make a blessing, because that is what Hashem tells us, that when you somebody gives you something, when somebody has you enjoy something, you have to bless them at the end. So it doesn't matter whether you're eating a candy, you're drinking water, or when you're thirsty, or you're after bracha, you always have to make a bracha. And, you know, by extension, we can learn from this that anytime somebody does something for you, something good for you, you need to bless them. You need to bless them, you need to thank them, but it's also to always recognize that Hashem is everything in the world, and we cannot just say we're entitled, you know, we're entitled to take, or it's owed to us, we have to get it. No. You have to make a bracha, you have to say thank you Hashem, and when you say thank you Hashem, that gives you the allowance and that gives you the permission to be able to benefit from him.